This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, June 6th. I'm John Wanamaker. Fewer Twin Cities homeowners are underwater on their mortgages. A report from the research firm CoreLogic shows 9.9% of residential mortgage holders in the metro owed more to banks than their property was worth. The figures from the first 3 months of the year are down about a third of a percent from the previous quarter. Herb Towsley, director of real estate programs at the University of St. Thomas, says the drop is small, but the market is continuing to move in the right direction. He says an increase in home prices helped many homeowners build equity. Towsley says things were far worse during the foreclosure crisis several years ago.
I've seen numbers in the high 30s, 30% range, that, you know, of all the homes that had a mortgage were underwater. So we've made significant progress, and I think we'll continue to do so.
Towsley also says more people are able to pay their mortgages because jobs are getting easier to find. Nationally, 12.7% of residential mortgages are underwater. U.S. railroads, forced to turn over details of their crude oil shipments, are asking states to sign agreements not to disclose the information. But some states are refusing, saying the information shouldn't be kept from the public. Federal officials last month ordered railroads to make the disclosures after a string of tank car accidents and fires in Castleton, North Dakota, Alabama, Virginia, and Quebec. The disclosures due midnight Saturday include route details, volumes of oil carried, and emergency response information for trains hauling 1 million gallons or more of crude. That's about 35 tank cars. The railroads are seeking agreements that the information won't be publicly shared. They say it's security sensitive, and releasing it could put them at a competitive disadvantage. Five environmental organizations are asking Xcel Energy to change the way it charges people for electricity. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
Currently, Xcel charges its residential customers a flat rate per kilowatt hour. It doesn't matter if you're the type of person who conserves or one who leaves the lights on all the time. But the environmental groups say that doesn't encourage people to save energy. So they want Xcel to charge a lower rate for the first 350 kilowatt hours and then charge higher rates if customers reach certain thresholds in their monthly electricity use. Will Nissen is a policy associate with Fresh Energy.
This is an opportunity to lower your energy bill in a way that's more beneficial to you as a low-use customer than the current flat rate structure. And it's an opportunity to take advantage of the best energy resource we have in Minnesota, which is simply the kilowatt hour you don't use.
Xcel officials say they are still reviewing the proposal.
That's reporter Elizabeth Dunbar. The Minnesota Supreme Court has denied a last-ditch effort to block construction of a new office building for the state Senate. Tim Pugmire has details.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals said last month that former Republican State Representative Jim Knobloch would have to post an $11 million bond to continue his legal challenge of the Senate office building. The three-judge panel said at the time that delaying construction would increase project costs. Knobloch appealed that ruling too, but the state Supreme Court rejected his argument. The latest ruling clears the way for a groundbreaking scheduled for early July. The new $90 million building will be constructed near the state capitol and will house senators from both parties as well as committee hearing rooms. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
The U.S. Attorney's Office has charged a 25-year-old Minneapolis man with trafficking at least three teenage girls. Brant Williams reports.
According to the indictment, Dontre McHenry used force and coercion to get three girls ages 15, 16, and 17 to have sex with men for money. Investigators say McHenry used online sources to sell the girls to Johns. The indictment says in March of this year, McHenry posted a picture on his Facebook page of himself holding money in his hands in a hotel room. The post allegedly contained a reference to prostitution. Investigators say McHenry knew the girls were under 18, and they say the 15-year-old was a runaway from Rochester. McHenry made his first appearance in federal court in front of a magistrate judge, but did not enter a plea. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
A Minnesota state agency soon will have to say in court why it should continue to hold a sex offender who committed his crimes as a juvenile. That's according to a federal judge's order this week. A panel of experts says the man should be released immediately from the Minnesota sex offender program. Peter Cox reports.
When he was 19 years old, the man identified in court documents by the initials ET was indefinitely committed for sex offenses that occurred between the ages of 10 and 14. The documents do not say when his commitment began, nor do they specify what his crimes were. The court documents say E.T. has no adult criminal history. The Minnesota Department of Human Services holds the man in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. DHS says he is one of 65 patients in the program who have no adult convictions. There are currently 691 sex offenders in the program, according to the DHS website. A federal court-appointed panel of experts unanimously recommended ET be released. They say there's little evidence he's dangerous or a risk to public safety.
It's the first time that there's been some conclusive evidence that supports the allegations we made that people are being held unconstitutionally in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Attorney Dan Gustafson represents the people in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in a federal class action lawsuit.
And so I think this is a really important step, and I don't think it's the last bit of evidence that we're going to develop.
In February, U.S. District Judge Donovan Frank ordered an independent panel of experts to evaluate everyone in the program. The panel started with the young adult, assisted living, and alternative program units. The majority of these offenders served prison time and were then civilly committed because they were deemed too dangerous to release. Some came straight from juvenile custody. The patients claim the Minnesota Sex Offender Program offers little rehabilitation or chance of release from facilities at Moose Lake and St. Peter. And they say the indefinite detention violates their constitutional right to due process. Dan Gustafson says in the history of the program, no one has been unconditionally released. One man was granted provisional release 2 years ago. As the experts evaluate more patients, he expects more orders.
I understand that they're going to issue these reports as they get them finished. This is the first one, but I'm certain there's more coming.
The Department of Human Services says in a statement they'll be challenging the panel's finding that ET should be released. They'll also defend the constitutionality of his custody. As they watch the controversy over the Minnesota Sex Offender Program play out in the courts, some lawmakers say the legislature passed up a chance to make changes. DFL State Representative Tina Liebling of Rochester says the legislature basically punted the issue during the session just ended.
It's very unfortunate that those decisions are being made by a federal court instead of in a process set up by the Minnesota legislature. That really shouldn't be happening, but we all knew that it was going to come to something like this if we didn't act, and we were not able to act.
Republican State Senator Warren Limmer of Maple Grove served on a panel that proposed changes in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. He says ET's case points to weaknesses in the current program.
If he's been incarcerated first for a full sentence under the criminal justice system and then immediately taken from there and brought to a civil commitment, if this person hasn't gotten out, if experts say that he's not a threat, one has to ask some serious questions of what kind of system do we have.
A federal court hearing on the order is set for June 25th in St. Paul. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. The University of Minnesota has named an outside body to manage a review of its clinical research practices. Alex Friedrich has more.
The review comes at the request of the U Senate faculty amid lingering questions over the 2004 suicide of a patient involved in a university drug trial. University bioethicist Lee Turner says the U doesn't need a superficial review of practices, but a real investigation.
And it's an investigation that needs to look at particular allegations of research misconduct.
The U hired the nonprofit Association for the Accreditation of Human Research Protection Programs. It will manage a team of experts from institutions such as Harvard Medical School and Johns Hopkins University. The panel is expected to issue a public report in 6 months. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A loaded handgun was found abandoned at a Target store in South Carolina last week, and that report is prompting a gun control advocacy group to repeat demands that the retailer prohibit the open carrying of guns in Target stores. Martin Moylan reports.
Last Friday, an employee at a Target store in Myrtle Beach found a handgun full of live ammo in the toy aisle. Police said the handgun was inside a Marvel superhero play school toy box. The employee thought it could have been a toy until realizing the gun was fully loaded. Target said the safety and security of employees and customers is a top priority, and it's partnering with police to investigate the incident. The gun control group Moms Demand Action said the incident shows Target should prohibit guns. The group has previously lobbied other leading merchants to restrict guns in their stores. The group has asked for bans in response to gun rights activists showing up at Target stores and other retailers with loaded rifles. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The city of St. Paul is expanding a program designed to prevent street crime among young people. The St. Paul Youth Initiative includes extended hours and more programming at rec centers paired with a team of nearly 30 community ambassadors. They'll take to the streets on weekend nights to keep kids from getting into trouble. Damon Drake helped train the ambassadors, many of whom already have personal connections to the young people in question.
And when they see some of these youth workers that are out there, they wouldn't dare do something. They might do something in front of the police, but they wouldn't do something in front of their coach or their teacher or their social worker. So that's an advantage that sometimes we have that the police don't have.
The city began the program as a pilot project last year, focusing on downtown. Police reported a drop in youth crime on nights the ambassadors worked. This summer, the initiative will expand to other parts of the city where crime has been a problem. More than half the funding for the $800,000 program will come from private philanthropy. For the first time, the city of Minneapolis is making so-called power dogs available for adoption at its animal shelter. Curtis Gilbert has details.
The city used to have a rule. It didn't adopt out Dobermans, Rottweilers, or Pit Bulls. Even puppies, who just wanted to play with chew toys. They would all go to rescue organizations or be euthanized. But now, City Council member Lisa Goodman says the city won't discriminate based solely on breed.
Those animals are equally as able to be adopted as poodles or Bichons or Labradors.
Instead, Animal Care and Control Coordinator Jeanette Wiedemeyer-Bauer says each dog will get an individual assessment.
There are great dogs and there are goofballs.
And some are just plain dangerous. But even with the nice ones, there are still more stray dogs than homes for them. Since 2010, the city has reduced the percentage of adoptable animals it puts down. The number was 60%. Now it's less than 20. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And finally, 70 years ago today, tens of thousands of American soldiers, sailors, and airmen were part of the attacking Allied force on the beaches of Normandy. It was one of history's greatest military endeavors as the effort to push Adolf Hitler's Nazi army out of France began, and Milton Guion was there. Guion, now 89 years old and living in May Township just outside of Stillwater, was a teenager in the 87th Chemical Mortar Battalion. He and the members of his unit landed on Utah Beach in the second wave of the D-Day assault. Resistance there wasn't as stiff as it was on nearby Omaha Beach, but there were hundreds of casualties nonetheless. Phil Picardi spoke with Guion about his part in the invasion and the weeks that followed. He says he doesn't hear as well as he used to and his memory is a bit clouded, but Guion remembers the faces of the young men and his gun crew who sailed with him to France that stormy day 70 years ago.
And each gun had nine men, and I think I remember about four of the names, and most of them are gone. Most of them were killed in action or wounded. Our medic, he was a conscientious objector. He was killed in action. And we had two medics, but the one of them was killed in action.
The infantry went in first, is that correct? And then
yeah.
You followed up right away?
Well, the tanks went in, infantry with the tanks, and then we went right behind them. We went in the second wave, let's see, 50, I think they said it was 50 minutes. This is all a matter of history because at that time we didn't really know, but they said it was 50 minutes after the first wave. But so there was a lot of casualties. And then the first night I remember crawling over dead Germans and dead Americans. And we were always under fire one way or another, with mostly seeing we weren't right with the infantry, we were behind the infantry a ways, so we were subject to German artillery and German mortars.
You were 19 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, I was one of the youngest men in the outfit.
And when you were on that boat that was being tossed on the waves, did you have any idea how important an operation it would end up being?
not really. I don't know. I guess when we went across the channel, that was the worst storm in 50 years that hit that channel. And Eisenhower, he says, storm or no storm, we're going. So.
Do you remember the training ahead of the actual invasion?
Yeah, we trained in England. Every day we went out for 5-mile walk and runs with, we must have had 50, 60 pounds that we carried. We had a 9-pound rifle and ammunition and a canteen and all the rest of the stuff. So we carried about 50 or 60 pounds. We'd run a 5-mile walk and run. We'd run a mile, walk a mile, run a mile, walk a mile. So we were supposed to be in good shape by the time we... But the only thing is, when we went across the channel, it was the worst storm that hit the channel in 50 years, and the ship bounced up and down, and we all got seasick. So
it almost didn't matter what kind of shape you were in and how much training you had done. By the time you actually got to Utah Beach, you weren't feeling very well, I guess.
That's right, but we had to there was no doubt about it. We had to keep going.
You had a job to do, and do you remember, were you frightened before the actual invasion?
Well, I guess everybody was. We all said our prayers. I carried my little Bible with me all the time.
Do you feel as though you're fortunate to have walked away after D-Day? Was it that frightening? Was it that scary on the beach that day?
I don't know. I thank the good Lord that I'm here. When I left my unit, just before the Battle of the Bulge in November, end of November, and I was suffering from PTSD and traumatic brain injury, TBI, and hearing loss, and frostbitten feet. So I wasn't really in too good a shape when I got in the hospital in Paris.
I guess in those days they didn't call it PTSD.
No, they had names for it. They called it hysterics in the barracks and static in the attic and shell shock and battle fatigue. And they had all kinds of names for it.
You still have difficulty hearing, but how about the PTSD symptoms? When you got back home to the States, did you go back to Minnesota right away?
Well, I got into a hospital in Camp Atterbury, Indiana. I spent 5 months in the hospital. We were trained, the psychiatrist and psychologist trained us, give us training for anger management and stress and grief and all kinds of problems like that. So I spent 5 months before I was discharged.
So did all of the treatment that you received before you were actually discharged, did that help you to cope with getting back to what we might see as being mundane situations here at home?
Well, we got the things, you know, when you came home, the people that were your relatives and friends and everything, they really didn't understand at all about what we had been through. So that was the hardest part, that people didn't really understand.
Aside from D-Day, what was, if you can pinpoint a moment in your 5 months after D-Day, what was the moment that was the most difficult to get through?
Well, I don't know. I guess it seemed like every day was difficult. We'd just hurry up and we'd set up our guns and fire and set them up and fire, and they moved us around all the time because we were mobilized. Each gun had a jeep that we hauled our guns around in the jeep, and then later on we got little track vehicles, which were like weasels. We called them mud hens. Anyway, they were about the size of a Jeep, only they had tracks. But I don't know. Every day was just a steady grind, except I think when we got up into Belgium, we had a couple of weeks of R&R. But other than that, why? And we got all new clothes and everything, and we finally got a chance to take a bath.
I think a lot of young people look to people like you and they say, you know what, I don't know if I could have done what Milton Guion did on D-Day 70 years ago.
Well, what we did was we had to do.
When people come up to you, Mr. Guion, and they say, thank you for your service,
I don't know how many people have thanked me and shake hands. I have that happen all the time.
And so what do you feel inside when they say thank you?
I just tell them you're welcome. That's about all. And I appreciate your feelings.
Do you think often about D-Day, or does it only happen when people like me, people in the media who want to talk to you about it, give you a call? Is it something that's on your mind a lot?
Well, off and on, yes and no, I guess, because I've had a lot of people talk to me, and then there's two different people from Belgium sent me letters and asked me for information about what I did and what was going on during the war, and they thanked me, and they asked me to send back pictures or information to them and as a World War II veteran. And then the French consulate, the French general consulate or whatever, a few years ago, they rounded up all the veterans that they knew of that went in on D-Day, and they had a big celebration in Hotel Sofitel in Minneapolis. We had a dinner and a big get-together, which was nice.
Now, there are not very many of you left who went in on D-Day who can actually still talk about it.
I don't know. Yesterday, my friend, 93 years old, passed away. And this last Christmas, just about everybody I know is gone. Last Christmas, another friend that I knew since I was 16 years old, he was a B-17 pilot. And I remember being on the ground and shaking my fist at the B-17s flying over, thanking the good Lord that the Mighty Eighth was up there. Because if it hadn't been for the Eighth Air Force, Germans would have pushed us right back into the ocean.
Have you been back to Normandy since D-Day?
No. They asked me. I said no, I'd cry. We lost so many men. There's the graveyard in Normandy has, I think, 9,800 casualties from that invasion. It's close to 10,000 men.
That was Milton Guion of May Township, Minnesota. Guion retired from his job 28 years ago. He was married for 63 years. His wife died in 2008. He has three children in their 50s and 60s. And on this date, 70 years ago, June 6, 1944, he was part of the Allied second attack wave on Utah Beach in Normandy, France. And that's the NPR News update for Friday, June 6th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.